I want you to picture two people, right? Two people whose professional lives normally have absolutely zero overlap.
Right, like completely different worlds.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So on one side of the world, you have this back-end software engineer. They are staring at a terminal, trying to build a system that automates complex code reviews.
Yeah, dealing with pure logic, syntax, stuff like that.
Right. And then literally on the other side of the world, you have a creative director in a high-end studio, and they're tweaking lighting effects for a 3D product launch inside Blender.
Right, totally different universe.
Historically, these two are living in completely different realities.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they operate with completely different tool sets, distinct workflows, and entirely different metrics for what even constitutes a successful day at work. You wouldn't expect them to care about the same software update.
But as of April 2026, their daily workflows have suddenly and kind of violently collided.
It's a massive collision.
Yeah, and that collision is the absolute focus of today's deep dive. We are looking at a really fascinating stack of sources today. On one hand, we have Anthropic's highly technical migration guide for their newly renamed Claude Agent SDK.
Right, very back-end focused.
Very. And on the other hand, we have this incredibly detailed workflow manual for integrating something called the Model Context Protocol.
Or MCP.
Yeah, MCP, directly into major creative software like Adobe, Ableton, Blender, and Splice.
And honestly, putting that developer migration guide right next to the Creative Studio manual, it reveals the massive paradigm shift that took place in the spring of 2026.
I mean, it really does.
Like, this isn't just a software update. It is a fundamental restructuring of how humans and machines interact.
It's an aha moment for sure. I mean, we are watching the exact second where raw backend code infrastructure merges with front-end creative production.
Yeah.
We are essentially exploring the shift in AI from being this, chatty advisor sitting in a browser tab.
Right, the chatbot era.
Exactly. Moving from that to becoming an autonomous embedded workflow engine that literally runs inside your software.
And crucially, we are exploring how to safely put guardrails around these really powerful new systems. Because, the sources emphasize that the shift is not about AI suddenly replacing humans in the creative process or even the engineering process for that matter.
Right, it's not the robot coming for your job.
Exactly. AI is transitioning into an infrastructure layer. It is moving from being a digital colleague you talk to the foundational plumbing that actually runs the building.
Okay, let's unpack that plumbing metaphor. Because before we can talk about using this new infrastructure for like 3D animation or music production, we have to understand the fundamental shift in how this technology is actually being packaged.
Yeah, how it's packaged and sold to developers.
Right. And that brings us to the April 2026 rebrand.
Oh, the rebrand. Yeah. So on April 8th, Anthropic shipped a major update that effectively drew a really hard line in the sand for
What
developers.
did they actually do?
Well, they took their existing developer package, which, everyone knew as the Anthropic AI Claude Code package, and they renamed it to the general purpose Claude Agent SDK.
Which, okay, at first glance, that just sounds like boring corporate naming semantics.
Right, just marketing.
Right, but the migration guide stresses that this rename is deeply structural. It is, it's like Anthropic took the proprietary, perfectly tuned engine out of their flashy consumer sports car.
Which was Claude Code.
Exactly. And they decided to just pull that engine block out and sell it directly to mechanics so those mechanics could build their own custom vehicles.
That's a great way to look at it. And they enforce that distinction with a very strict branding prohibition.
Oh, yeah. This part was wild.
Right. The migration guide explicitly states that partners can no longer use the Claude code name for their products.
And they went even further than just the name, right?
Yeah, they are even prohibited from using the Claude code ASCII art in their terminal interfaces.
They banned the ASCII art. I mean, the lawyers really got involved there.
Well, they kind of had to. They needed to signal to the market that Claude Code is now strictly an end-user terminal application. While the Agent SDK, that is the foundational infrastructure. It's the platform upon which developers build custom autonomous agents.
So if you're building a product, your positioning has to reflect that you are building on the SDK, not just modding the consumer app.
Exactly. But with this grand rebrand, there's a pretty significant operational catch.
Ah, there's always a catch.
Right. The sources highlight a major billing shift that kicks in on June 15th, 2026. Suddenly, using the Agent SDK no longer draws from your standard Claude plan limits.
Wait, so where does it draw from?
It pulls from a separate monthly Agent SDK credit bucket.
Oh, wow. So if you manage a team of developers, this June 15th change is going to be a massive headache if you don't prep for it.
A huge headache.
Is this just like a way to squeeze more money out of enterprise users, or does it actually change the deployment strategy?
It forces a highly necessary change in deployment strategy, specifically regarding automation and risk management.
Okay, how so?
Well, before this billing split, a team might just assume their unified subscription covered everything, right?
Yeah.
So they would run a developer experimenting locally on their laptop from the exact same bucket as their continuous integration pipelines.
Right. And just to clarify for those outside of software engineering, a continuous integration pipeline, or a CI, is essentially the automated system that runs tests and builds your code every single time a developer hits save or merges a new feature.
Exactly. It's the factory floor.
So teams were basically throwing human experimentation and massive automated robotic workloads onto the exact same company credit card.
Yes, which is a classic anti-pattern.
An anti-pattern being a recurring response to a problem that usually backfires.
Right, is highly counterproductive because interactive development and automated CI workloads, they have completely different failure modes.
Give me an example of that.
Well, if a human developer gets stuck on a coding problem, what do? They pause, they think about it, or maybe they just go get a coffee.
Yeah, they stop spending API credits.
Exactly. But if an automated agent gets stuck in a loop trying to solve a bug in a CI pipeline, it doesn't get a coffee. It might execute thousands of attempts over a weekend.
And suddenly you come in on Monday morning and your agent SDK credits are completely drained.
Down to zero.
Oh.
Just because a robot couldn't figure out a basic syntax error?
Yikes. So the new billing structure really forces teams to recognize those distinct risks.
It does. You now have to identify your execution surface. You have to log your billing path separately, and you definitely have to set up strict CI budget alarms.
Okay, so now that we know we are working with this raw engine block, and we know we're paying for the gas separately.
Very important point.
We really need to pop the hood here. Let's examine the specific gears and levers developers are using to actually build these autonomous systems. And from the sources, it looks like the absolute core of this is the query API.
Yeah, the query API is basically the heartbeat of the SDK. It's what we call an asynchronous generator.
Asynchronous generator. Mm-hmm. What does that actually mean in practice?
It means it yields messages as the agent works through a task. It is not a single input-output exchange like the old chatbots. It functions much more like a tennis match between the system and the AI.
A tennis match. I like that.
Yeah, and there are four key outputs in this match that you have to track.
Okay, lay them out for me.
You have the system message, the assistant message, the tool result message, and finally the result message.
Let's visualize that tennis match for the listener. How does the volley actually work when the agent first gets a task?
Okay, so the serve, the very first hit, is the system message. That fires first, and it establishes the session ID and registers any available tools or connected servers that the AI can use.
So setting the rules of the court.
Exactly. Then the model takes a turn. It generates an assistant message. Now, this contains Claude's reasoning text, but more importantly, it contains the specific tool calls it wants to make based on the problem.
So this is like the AI deciding, okay, I need to look inside the authentication folder to fix this login bug.
Spot on. Then the underlying system takes that tool call, it actually executes it, and it volleys back a tool result message.
And that contains the output of the action?
Right. For instance, the actual list of files it found in that authentication folder.
Okay, I see.
And this back and forth just continues. The AI asks for data, the system provides it, the AI asks to edit a file, the system confirms the edit.
And it just loops.
Yep, it loops until the task is complete, and it ends with a result message that hands over the final answer, and very importantly, logs the total token usage.
Got it. And the sources highlight something really interesting here, something they call the magic of session continuity.
Oh, this is a game changer.
Yeah, because when that very first system message fires, it gives you a session ID, right?
Right.
And the SDK is literally saving the state of this entire tennis match locally on your machine as JSON files.
Yes. The use of JSON, which is JSON line's format, is a massive, massive efficiency upgrade for the AI's context window.
Because it's not loading one huge file every time.
Exactly. Instead of loading one giant monolithic database file every single time the AI needs to remember something, JSON lines allows the system to just append a new line of text to the end of the file for every new action.
It's basically giving the AI a highly optimized, localized short-term memory.
Precisely.
So if an error occurs or, you know, you just want to pause the agent and go to lunch, you just pass that session ID back in later.
Yeah, Claude doesn't have to reread your entire code base or repeat tool calls it already made.
It just reads the sequential lines in the local JSON file and picks up exactly where it left off.
Which saves an incredible amount of compute and money.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, memory is really only useful if the agent can actually affect its environment.
Right, it needs hands.
Exactly. Yeah. And the SDK ships with 10 built-in capabilities or tools.
10 tools.
Yeah. You have your standard tools like read and edit for manipulating text.
Yeah.
You have web search. You also have glob, which is super useful.
Well,
yeah, it allows the agent to use wildcard characters to search for specific file patterns, like finding every single image file across dozens of nested folders simultaneously.
Oh, okay. But there is one tool in that list of 10 that the sources flag with a massive glowing warning sign.
Yes. The bash tool.
The bash tool.
The ability to run raw terminal commands. The documentation makes a very, very sharp distinction regarding where this tool should be deployed.
Because it's dangerous, right?
Extremely. If you are running an agent in a fully sandboxed CI container up in the cloud, giving it bash access is generally standard practice.
Because if it breaks, yeah, who cares?
Right, the container is isolated. If something breaks, you literally just spin up a new one in seconds.
Yeah.
But on a developer's local workstation,
yeah,
it is incredibly dangerous.
Let's be really clear about what that means for the listener. Because if you just blindly enable all 10 tools on your local machine, you are giving an AI the ability to run terminal commands with your exact user permission.
Yep, every permission you have, it has.
So if the agent gets confused while trying to, say, clean up some temporary files.
Which happens.
And it decides the most efficient route is to execute a recursive delete command like an ARM-MRF on your root directory.
Oh, boy.
Your personal files, your photos, your local databases, they are just gone.
Gone. You are basically handing over the keys to the kingdom to a system that can hallucinate. The rule established in the migration guide is absolute.
Which is?
If you do not explicitly need shell execution for a specific task, you do not include the bash tool in the allowed tools list, period.
That is a terrifying amount of power for a single agent to have.
It is.
But the SDK introduces an architectural concept to kind of help manage that complexity, right? Sub-agents.
Yes. The agent tool allows a parent agent to spawn specialized sub-agents to handle really focused subtasks. It completely changes how we structure automated work.
Now, a lot of people might assume the parent agent is just like a project manager delegating to freelance AI workers.
That's a common analogy, yeah.
But from a technical standpoint, the sources make it read much more like microservices for reasoning.
Oh, that is a much more accurate way to frame it.
Oh, so?
In software engineering, moving from a monolithic application to microservices means breaking down one massive, tangled code base into small, independent services that just communicate with each other.
Right.
Sub-agents do the exact same thing for the AI's context window.
So instead of feeding the parent agent this massive monolithic prompt where it has to remember the overarching strategy, write the code, run the tests, and document the changes all at the exact same time, you break it apart.
Exactly. The parent agent focuses purely on orchestration and routing.
It's just the traffic cop.
Yes. Yeah. When it hits a specific problem, let's say debugging a database query, it spawns a subagent. It gives that subagent only the relevant files, and then it just waits for the result.
So the parent's memory isn't cluttered with database syntax.
Exactly. This keeps the parent's context window pristine. It reduces the token cost massively, and it prevents the model from losing the forest for the trees.
And you can track all of this.
Yeah, you track all of this delegation through a specific parent to lucid field in your audit logs.
Okay, so if we have this architecture where a parent orchestrator is spinning up specialized processes to interact with specific environments, this completely reframes how non-coders can use this technology.
It absolutely does.
We are no longer just talking about terminal windows here. Through the Model Context Protocol MCP, these exact same underlying tools are now plugging directly into the interfaces used by musicians, animators, and designers.
Right. So if we fast forward a few weeks from the SDK rename, we hit April 28, 2026.
The big launch.
Anthropic announces Claude for Creative Work. This is the moment MCP really becomes visible to the broader public.
And they launched a bunch of connectors right out of the gate.
9 creative connectors. And these include major industry standards. We're talking Ableton for music production, Adobe for design, Autodesk Fusion, Blender for 3D animation, and Splice for audio sample libraries.
This right here is where the back-end engineer and the creative director collide. The exact same protocol connecting a custom subagent to a SQL database is now connecting Claude to an Ableton Live set.
It's the same underlying plumbing.
But I guess my question is, if I'm a music producer using Ableton, why do I actually need this embedded? I have a browser on my second monitor. I can just type my question into a chat window like I always have.
That's a great question, and the sources draw a critical line here. They divide the interaction into advice mode and action mode.
Okay, what's the difference?
Well, if you just want to ask a question, you are in advice mode. You might describe a weird audio routing issue you're having, or paste in a marketing brief and Claude reasons through it.
It gives you a checklist or something.
Right, gives you a troubleshooting checklist. But it changes absolutely nothing in your actual software.
Okay, so advice mode is essentially a very smart backseat driver.
Yes.
But action mode.
Yeah.
That is what happens when you actually map this infrastructure to the software itself.
Exactly. Action mode leverages the full MCP mapping structure.
Walk me through that structure.
Okay, you have five main components. Mm-hmm. You have the host, the connector, the tool, the resource, and the checkpoint.
Let's break that architecture down so we can really visualize what's happening when the AI takes the wheel.
All right, let's use Blender as an example. The host is the creative application itself. So Blender.
Got it.
The connector, or server, is the bridge that Anthropic provides. That connector exposes specific tools, which in this case are direct calls to Blender's Python API.
Okay.
The resource is your actual 3D scene file.
So when you ask Claude to change the lighting, it isn't just giving you a list of instructions.
No, it is invoking a tool to inspect the resource and then executing a script that fundamentally alters your active project files.
Which immediately raises a massive red flag for anyone working in the creative industry.
Ooh, absolutely.
Right. Because if I'm paying a high-end agency and the AI has the ability to invoke Python scripts that manipulate 3D scenes and audio timelines, isn't the creative director out of a job? Like, why do I need a human if the infrastructure can just ingest a brief and output a rendered file?
It's a very common fear, but the manual shows how that really misunderstands the limitations of the system. Giving the AI the steering wheel requires an immense amount of structured human oversight.
So it's not totally autonomous?
Not at all. The AI is a workflow layer. It scales output and automates repetition. It is not the creative director.
Because an AI doesn't have taste.
Exactly.
It can generate a technically correct Python script to add a light source, sure. But it doesn't intuitively know if that lighting actually fits the moody, premium aesthetic of the specific brand identity.
Right, nor can it reliably navigate complex licensing laws or determine if a destructive edit to a file is actually what the client wants.
The human has to remain in the loop to supply those constraints.
Always. And the sources refer to this structured oversight as maintaining state and enforcing checkpoints.
Let's talk about file state, because the creative manual explicitly warns against using vague prompts. Like, you can't just open the MCP window connected to Blender and type, make this scene look premium.
No, because premium is a highly subjective judgment. But more importantly, that prompt provides zero file state context.
It's missing all the parameters.
Right. It hides a dozen crucial operational decisions. The AI needs to know, what is the current working file? Is it allowed to modify the active file, or must it create a duplicate first?
Which specific layers or objects are even in scope?
Exactly. What is the naming convention for AI-altered assets? It needs all of that.
So I can't just wave a magic wand. I have to design a small, standard operating procedure. I have to explicitly say, inspect a duplicate of this Blender file, draft a script for the lighting setup, show me the script, and wait for my approval.
Yes, you are orchestrating the process. And to enforce those procedures, the manual outlines a mandatory six-step checkpoint system for production control.
These are the fences around the sandbox.
Exactly.
Let's flow through these six checkpoints using a realistic scenario. Say, adding an audio track to a commercial campaign. Before any software is even touched, we hit checkpoint one.
Right. Checkpoint one is the brief. What exact outcome are we actually trying to produce?
So we need a heavy bass drop for a 10-second social media ad.
Perfect. Then checkpoint two is scope. Which files and tool actions are actually allowed to achieve this?
Okay, so we restrict the AI to read-only access on the master timeline, and we only allow it to search the Splice audio library. We keep it strictly in a box.
Good. Then we hit checkpoint 3.
Which is?
Preview. This is the dry run. The AI must report what it intends to change before it executes anything.
So it says, hey, I'm going to fetch the specific bass drop from Splice and insert it at the 5-second mark.
Exactly. And once we approve that, we move to checkpoint 4, execution.
That's what the tool is actually called.
Right. And the human verifies that the connector did only the approved work.
Like making sure it didn't accidentally delete the dialogue track while it was placing the bass drop.
Which is a very real possibility.
Yeah.
Then checkpoint 5 is review. Now, this is the most critical human domain.
Does the result satisfy taste, brand guidelines, and legal rights?
Exactly. And finally, checkpoint 6 is rollback.
Oh, having an undo button.
Basically, if the client absolutely hates the bass drop, do we have a verified path, like a simple street or LZ, or a saved version state, to completely revert the file?
I really want to zoom in on checkpoint 5 for a second, that review phase, especially the legal rights aspect.
It's a huge issue.
Because the manual uses Splice as an example, and it perfectly illustrates why these checkpoints aren't just about making things look or sound pretty. They are about sheer legal survival.
Oh, absolutely. Splice is a massive library of audio samples.
Yeah.
And the MCP connector allows Claude to search that library and pull audio directly into your project.
Right.
But Splice has incredibly complex licensing agreements.
Like, some samples are royalty-free for commercial use, but others might have restrictions depending on your subscription tier.
Right, or the intended platform, or even the overall size of the marketing campaign.
So if you tell the agent to find a heavy bass drop, the AI might find a sonically perfect sound. It hits really hard.
It sounds great.
But it doesn't intuitively understand the legal nuances of your specific commercial campaign. It just executes the fetch command.
Exactly. And if you bypass that review checkpoint, just because the AI is so fast and efficient, you might end up shipping a global ad campaign using an audio sample you don't actually have the commercial rights to use.
That is a nightmare scenario.
It is. The AI can automate the fetch, but the human must verify the license. The tool call is explicit, but the liability remains entirely human.
Man. Okay, let's bring this all together. Over the course of this deep dive, we've gone from the raw back-end code of the Claude Agent SDK through the memory systems of JSON Lions and the orchestration of subagents.
All the way to a creative director managing 3D scenes in Blender and audio licenses in Ableton.
And what we've ultimately discovered is that whether you are automating NPM package updates or connecting to a live music set, the underlying philosophy dictating the future of work is exactly the same.
It really is.
We have fully exited the era of AI just acting as an oracle that gives you ideas in a little chat window.
That era is over.
We have entered a world of bounded infrastructure level automation. The real utility is now happening through structured tool calls, local session memory, and incredibly strict human oversight.
It is a massive shift toward treating AI as a highly capable, but ultimately subordinate workflow layer. It will scale your output exponentially, but it will never, ever absolve you of the responsibility for the final product.
Which brings up a scenario I want to leave you with, something for you to just mull over on your own that really tests the limits of this new infrastructure.
Okay.
We know from the developer side that parent agents can orchestrate specialized subagents to run automated tasks without human intervention, right?
Yes, that's the CI pipeline scenario.
And we know from the creative side that MCP connectors can reach out into external libraries like Splice to pull down raw assets.
Right.
So imagine an automated CI build running in the cloud at 3 a.m.,
okay.
It triggers an autonomous subagent to fetch a placeholder sound file for a nightly software build. But that subagent hallucinates its understanding of the Splice licensing agreement.
Right.
It embeds a commercially restricted audio file directly into the code. The build passes. The video game ships globally. And because it was all handled via back-end automated orchestration,
that asset never hit a human review checkpoint.
Exactly. When the massive copyright lawsuit inevitably hits, where does the liability actually fall?
That is the million-dollar question.
When the infrastructure makes a legal error at the speed of code, who is responsible? Is it the developer who wrote the orchestration script?
Maybe.
Is it the AI provider who supplied the engine block? Or is it the company whose logo is on the box? The safety nets of our traditional workflows are dissolving, and we are stepping into some very, very murky waters.
It is without a doubt the defining question for the next era of automated infrastructure.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.